Hello, and welcome to the Mail Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 comics sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top comic sales through Diamond to retailers in North America for June 2019. Now, we've got the top 500 comics, but when we talk about the breakdown and month-to-month comparisons, I limit it to the top 300 because we've got that going back to February 2003, so we can do some apples-to-apples comparisons there. Now, if we look at that grand total for the number of units sold into stores, actually, before I get going to this, I always skip the step. We've got Eric tonight. How you doing tonight, Eric?
I'm doing good.
Good, good. Because as you can tell, I was so excited, I just leapt right into it.
Hey, these are numbers, man. They're exciting.
They are. Well, they are. And sometimes there's new and interesting things to say. Sometimes there's old and still interesting things to say.
Very true.
This time around, it was... What I found interesting with the numbers is if you total it up for the top 300, we had 6,271,535 units sold to retailers for the top 300 comics. That's ballpark average. It's down about 315,000 from last month. And the average, the running average is, let's see, 6.6 million plus some change. So we're really not too far below that. However, this is the eighth month in a row of below average sales for the top 300 comics. That's not good. It's the longest range of sales for the top 300 below the running average since the 23-month range from October 2009 to August 2011.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we know that was basically what led up to the rebirth stuff over, or the New 52 stuff over at DC.
Right.
You know, they had also noticed some apathy in their books, and that's never a good thing when you're selling entertainment. So that period, though, from 2009 to 2011 included the all-time low for the top 300 of 4.4 million units in January 2011. So we're well above kind of that low watermark, but that was a pretty damn low watermark.
Correct.
So the fact that 23-month range from October 2009 to August 2011 averaged about 89% of the running average at the time isn't too bad. This 8-month period is about 91% of the running average. So sales could be better. They could be worse. I don't think we're in the best of times. But we're certainly not in the worst of times either.
Yeah, no, I would agree 100%. And I think, you know, unfortunately, it's too bad that low watermark came shortly before the New 52. But, you know, I have to say, at least in our store, we're seeing those slumping sales coming from DC. I don't know what it is, but that seems to be the publisher right now outside of those boutique bat titles. That seems to be overall just kind of down. And again, that apathy setting in.
I can definitely relate to that on a very personal level because I had been all in both at Marvel, DC, and a few other publishers, but it got to the point where it seemed like the publishers in general, and DC sometimes in specific, didn't care enough about the stories they were telling. I mean, they would just take some of it and sweep it under the rug and say, ah, that never happened. We're going this way now. You do that enough, and it's like, what's the point in reading this?
Right.
And
right.
I think DC is frankly doubling down on that strategy with things like the Tales from the Dark Multiverse or whatever it is coming up, where they're doing kind of essentially Elseworlds books or what-if books, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got so many different versions of their main characters and stuff, particularly Batman, that it makes me wonder if the quote-unquote real version matters.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And then the only other thing that I would add into that is coming out around Comic-Con time, we had the news article that highlighted Dan DiDio's comments around the facsimile editions. And I think depending on who you are and how you read it, you interpreted it slightly different. But the main gist of it that I picked up was that he was frustrated that facsimile editions could even dare bother outsell a new book.
I think he should be very concerned about that.
I would agree. And as a retailer, now, yes, of course, the facsimile editions are oftentimes a key book that is a valuable book. But I'm sorry, if your facsimiles are selling heads and tails higher than your other output, that should be a warning sign to say we need to change up the formula in some fashion. Either we need different creative talent, either we need to look at storytelling differently. Something's got to change, because there's no reason why you can't have books that outsell facsimiles. Marvel does frequently, and you know what? Hey, maybe it's because they're gaming the system. Well, I'm sorry, DC Comics, maybe you need to step into that and do it too. There's a lot of things out there, and it feels like right now DC is just sitting there, kind of they're the boat that's got no engine and they've only got one oar, so they're just kind of going in a circle. And I don't know if it's because they've got some grand scheme that none of us are aware of yet that they're coming up with. Hopefully that's the case. I'm gonna give them the benefit of the doubt, but you know, as of right now, there's so many warning signs. I don't know how they're not looking at that.
I think they are looking at it, and they've shown in the past an ability to see the warning signs and do something about it. What I'm not as confident in is that they can do something successful about it.
Well, how many times do you let the same people do the same changing? That's really what it comes down to me.
Yeah, I do think that there is a need for a change up in the leadership of DC Comics. And I say DC Comics specifically, not DC Entertainment, not Warner Brothers, none of that stuff, but the people actually doing the comic book publishing.
Yeah, I agree. And I want it to be known, these are people that I know and that I like. You know, I consider them slightly more than acquaintance, slightly less than a friend. But at the same time, you have to get to a point where you say something, the denominator of this equation has not changed, and yet we can't seem to find the right thing. Maybe we need to change that denominator.
I guess the question, though, is what person or people in the leadership do you feel needs to change? Because it's easy to look at Jim Lee and Dan Didio as potential, you know, people to swap out or something. But I think both of them do provide significant value in the leadership structure. I'm almost questioning if Bob Harris, the editor-in-chief, is the weak link.
He's the one that I, for quite a while, have said needs to look at being replaced. I will also admit, though, perhaps Jim and or Dan may need, there may need to be something looked at there. And the only reason I say that is, you know, where does the power rest? And if ultimately Bob is taking direction from Dan and or Jim, then that there needs to be a change there, I guess, is what I'm saying. Is if you can't let your editor have enough sway to make change, and it's going to be the publishers that keep pushing it, then you've got to find where that repeated problem is.
That's fair. That's fair. And I do think that maybe that the roles that they're playing may need to get modified a little bit, because while I think Dan Didio can be a great cheerleader and kind of front man for the company, and I certainly think Jim Lee, from an artistic point of view, has a lot he can offer the entire line of DC. Where I think they're lacking is a really good kind of chief creative officer that can have the vision for the future of the DC universe. Because at least for me, that's where it's falling flat.
Yeah, I think that's where, I think that's the problem that DC is having. I mean, we look at comic books, and in our store, we do. We have an influx of new people. It's not massive. And it generally for us, thankfully, has been more than those that are atrophied and leaving, either leaving the hobby, leaving certain books. But I think what you're seeing is that what's catching new readers are the 6-issue miniseries, you know, boutique bat titles and things like that, the Mr. Miracles, those small things that get an inordinate amount of hype. But where you're losing people and not getting people is on your core titles that you're not pushing any advertisement towards. Like, when was the last time you saw an advertisement for Aquaman? Heck, Wonder Woman. You don't see them pushing those things as much. And then on top of it, you've kind of cast away the continuity in the past, or you've at least given the impression that it doesn't matter. So your longtime reader, much to the comments you've made in the past of saying, you know, like, well, if you don't care about it, why should I?
Uh-huh.
And if that doesn't matter, then, you know, this story right now doesn't really have me. So I'm going to step out. Maybe I'll come back later when a new creative team comes on. That's to me where the risk and the problem is you can't keep the old readers because you're kind of throwing that away, or at least saying it's not important. You can't get the new readers because you've overinvested on, I hate to say it, but things like Doomsday Clock that are so chronically late at this point that the momentum is almost going backwards on it, that there's a disparity there. Like you can't, you're not promoting home base. You're not taking care of home base. So why should anyone care?
Yeah. And
which is a shame.
I do think that's a serious problem at DC, and it's ironic that their former chief creative officer, Jeff Johns, is kind of the linchpin of some of those delays, both for Doomsday Clock and Shazam. I was looking at one of the recent shipping updates from Diamond, and I think there were 4 issues of Shazam that were getting delayed.
Yep.
It's a trickle. Once one gets delayed, the ones after it have to and stuff. But, I mean, the thing just came out, the Shazam movie just came out on Blu-ray and such. Man, it'd be a great time for there to be a series firing on all cylinders for the character.
Yeah, it's one of those things where as a business person first, both business of a comic store and just working in corporate America in a management role, the whole thought of saying this creator, this individual is behind on their work, I should give them more work, it just doesn't register. Well, like
not even more work, but putting them on kind of the critical path.
Right.
It's a bad idea.
It is a bad idea. And again, Jeff Johns, when his head is in the creative game and he's doing it, there's very few people that can put together the things that he has. I mean, agreed. Look at his track record. He's an amazing creator. But it's very obvious that right now, being a writer for comic books is not the top thing on his list. Heck, at the rate he's putting things out, I'd say it's probably not in the top 5. And you know what? Part of it could be family. I know he's got kids. I'm in the same boat, and that's the right thing to do. But if you've got other work things taking away from what you're doing, like you said, on a critical path or on, kind of shaping of the DC universe, you've got to be smart enough to either say, I can't take on anymore, I shouldn't be put on this project, or I need somebody else to come in and fill in the gaps. Here's the rough plot. Let someone else do the scripting. I'll do an edit, and then we'll go for it.
Yeah. Or even if for some reason you couldn't do that, find some way to offload something else on his plate.
Right.
To free up his time and his focus. Because I agree, when Jeff Johns is at his A game, man, he completely, reinvigorated the Justice Society group of characters. Made that a linchpin for the DC Universe for quite some time.
All of his work with the Green Lantern.
The Green Lantern stuff, man, the way he expanded that franchise with the different cores and stuff, that was gold. You look at some of the stuff he did with the Legion of Superheroes, with the Batman and the Legion of Superheroes, the Legion of Three Worlds and stuff like that. He has reinvigorated parts of the DC Universe that, unfortunately, since then have kind of fallen by the wayside, almost.
Yep.
It's a shame that all the hard work he did is kind of not paying off for DC right now, and that he's not able to kind of have that kind of influence in other areas of DC also.
Right. And I'll have to say, I think, I don't know how this is going to land, so I'm just going to say it the way that I think it. I look at every business, maybe not down to the smallest of the small, but I look at any business, especially corporate business, and DC is a corporate entity, you have to have succession plans.
Yes.
Right. If the leader steps out, who's next? If that person bumps up, who's next? And you have to work your way through. And I look at DC Comics as a mix between corporate America in that regard and a sports team. Professional sports teams have the minor leagues. The teams that do the best are the ones that have the best farm system, the best minor league system. They're the ones that are putting extra money in. They're doing extra work. And they're pushing harder and harder and finding new talent. And that's something that I think in general, DC right now isn't doing. They're more in the role of go out and acquire a name. I'm going to go out and get Tom King, take him away from Marvel. Bendis, I know his time at Marvel ended, and DC did the right thing and said, hey, we've got a great opportunity. But with Tom King, and you've got, I was just listening to the latest episode that you and James recorded. The Superboy, Jimmy Olsen, who was the writer for that. A great creator, but also very chronic in slowing down and not getting what he's doing. It's one of those things where if you don't have people in the pipeline, you've got to get a new pipeline. Like if you don't have confidence in the people that you're building, you got to go get new people.
Even if you do have confidence, there's nothing to say that some other company is not going to snap them up into an exclusive, or they get hit by a bus or something and are otherwise unavailable, or they get snapped up by Hollywood.
Right. I mean, I see reports of, these pupils going through the Kubert School, and you've got these people that are going through the DC New Writer Program, and you don't hear anything from them.
Well, I think
it's kind of like, what the heck? Where'd they go?
To me, that'd be the equivalent of a major league sports team going to the high schools, picking some kids and saying, well, we're going to teach you how to play the game. You know, right. You want people who are passionate enough to be out there doing it and then be snapping them up. And even if you've got a completely full bench of just all stars and you can't imagine having a better group of creators, you still want to have people waiting in the wings.
Exactly.
Either you can expand your line, you can speed up your production if you wanted to, or you can spell some of these people when they have something happen that takes them out of the game for a bit.
Exactly. Yep. And I mean, like, for me, the best example that I can see of kind of a pseudo secession plan is the Scott Snyder, James Tynion plan. And that is, Scott was James' teacher when he was at whatever writing academy he was in. Scott was his professor. Mm-hmm. So he developed a relationship. They realized that they think of things in the same fashion. And it was a natural thing for DC to say, well, Scott, who do you see? Scott says, I see James. They say, James, come on and look at where he's gone. So it's one of those things where it can be done, but I feel like DC is more on the go out and acquire a name as opposed to grow their talent as strongly as I think they could.
I think that's a fair assessment, which is unfortunate because they frankly need to do better. I mean, they've had times at DC where they've had some really strong editors and stuff that were able to get really good stuff out of the creators. They've had times they've had a great creative lineup, and their lineup now isn't bad, but they're not able to get the right people on the right books with the right take at the right time and keep the books coming out on time.
Right. Now, if we take that and we look at the numbers, though, for the month, we can see some interesting, to me, just between Marvel and DC, some interesting stuff that can be used as an argument against some of what we're saying, and you could maybe make an argument that DC's on more solid footing. You've got 101 new titles for Marvel and 50 new titles for DC. Marvel has, if you add up the reorder items, you have 111 for Marvel and 53 for DC Comics. Then total units, you've got 3.2 million units for Marvel, 1.7 for DC, $13.2 million in the dollar share, and $8 million for DC in the dollar share. So you start looking at these numbers and you see, well, okay, percent of top comics by unit, 51.8% for Marvel, 28.6% for DC. Now, if it's 100 to 50 comics from DC, 100 comics from Marvel, that's a doubling up. Maybe you'd expect to see a double up in the percent of unit share, but it's 28%, 51, it'd be 56 if it was doubled. So, okay, maybe you could argue that DC is doing more with less. Percent of the dollars, 50.4% for Marvel, 30.5% for DC. Again, maybe you could say they're doing more with less.
I think you could argue Marvel's also doing more with less some months, particularly when they've got a month where they put out 10 of those True Believers.
Correct. And in this month, DC had a $9.99 book. I think Marvel's highest price was $7.99. So, I mean, you can argue things a lot of different ways, but one thing I can say for sure is that we don't sell as much DC right now as we do Marvel.
Well, I think it's the entire time I've been looking at the numbers. And I've got not only the Final Order era that goes back to February 2003, I'd been tracking another couple of years prior to that, going back to 1998, I think it was, with the pre-order stuff. And more often than not, like 4 out of 5 months, Marvel's ahead of DC. Well, really ahead of everybody at that point, really. Not necessarily with the 50% plus, but they are the industry leader. So it's not just that Marvel's beating DC now, but it routinely does that. Now, we've got some people on the Slack channel and the forum and stuff who's equated that with, well, Marvel must have the better characters. And I really don't buy that. Now, I'm not saying DC definitely has the better characters, but I don't think DC's characters are certainly any less than Marvel's.
I think Marvel's just doing more with their characters right now, or at least has more interest in their characters.
I think they're definitely doing more, not only in terms of how they're successfully leveraging them in the comics, but I think over the last 10, 11 years, how they've taken what were considered their lesser characters, although even that terminology boggles my mind, and successfully turned them into the biggest franchise ever in movies. Now, if you can somehow consider Iron Man, Captain America, Thor, the Avengers and such, lesser characters than other parts of Marvel, like, you know, Spider-Man and the X-Men. I'd quibble with you on that, but to each their own. But when you've got at DC, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, I mean, these are if you were to go to a random street corner in anywhere in America and ask, name some superheroes, you know, now granted, it's more tilted towards the Marvel movies these days, but if you were to go in comics, those are ones historically over most of the last century, at least since they started 80 years ago or whatever, would have been listed.
Yeah, I can't remember where I heard it, but I remember hearing someone say, at least up until the Marvel movies were released, like the number one brand in the world was Batman. And it's like, well, okay, can a character be a brand? But it was, because everybody knew Batman, whether it was the theme song, whether it was the logo, whether it was whatever. Everybody knew Batman.
Absolutely. At one point, the top five recognized characters in the world, and this goes back at like 15 years or something, and I'm doing this from memory, so I may be wrong. I'm pretty sure included Batman, Superman, Mickey Mouse, Sherlock Holmes, and I don't remember the fifth one.
Hmm.
And these are, again, Superman, Batman, they are iconic parts of Earth culture. It's not even, you right. know, North American culture kind of stuff. It's global. So right. I don't buy that. Well, if DC just had better characters. Now, I do buy the theory that at times DC leadership has bought into that theory, because there have been numerous times of, well, let's just kick Superman to the curb and get somebody else in his place. Same with Batman, same with Wonder Woman and such. I mean, they've done that numerous times over the last 10 years, and it's a mistake, I think. Now,
yeah, and you can say, too, though, that over Marvel's history, there's been a cycle. There's always a cycle of which franchise is the hottest. Is it the Avengers? Is it the X-Men? Is mm-hmm. it, you know, so that's not to say that that doesn't happen. But when you've got the brand recognition of your Trinity, you know, your Batman, Superman and Wonder Woman that all had live action television shows and have had multiple live action television shows. Yeah. to kind of set them aside and say not as important right now is a foolish move.
Well, let's just for a moment dive out of comics to the mass media type stuff. Marvel is basically saying, let's take our key comic characters, put them front and center in the movies. DC, with the Berlanti shows, has taken some of their lesser rung on their totem pole characters, like Green Arrow, successfully turned him into a 7-8 season TV show, then The Flash, then Supergirl, Legends of Tomorrow, which is much further down the totem pole in how elevated those characters are in the comics and such.
Right.
But let's look a little further afield to what they've been doing elsewhere. Let's tell Batman before Batman with Gotham, much like they told Clark Kent before Superman in Smallville.
Right.
Hey, that's not going far enough back. Let's go do Pennyworth and tell about Alfred before Batman. And let's go tell the story of Superman's grandfather on Krypton. How far back do you need to keep stepping to where you get to what somebody would consider an interesting story to tell? I mean, there's yep. an aspect of, well, why can't you just tell Batman and Superman on TV? Now, we're getting close. We got Supergirl and we're going to have Batwoman. But even then, that's a step removed.
Yeah, and you can argue that because of the character makeup of those two characters, it's very different than Batman and Superman. It's not bad. It's just different. It's not the same.
You could almost say they're pandering to the diversity crowd or something. And I do think having more diverse characters than white male heroes is a good thing.
Oh yeah, you're not going to hear me argue that. I can't agree more with you. I think that these aren't, in my opinion, really mystified characters that you can't quite put your thumb on. They've been around in culture for a long enough time period that enough people know. Kind of goes back to how many times we have to retell Batman's origin. We all know it. We knew it before we saw it the second time, the third time, the 12th time. We all know his origin. So, okay, we all know he's the Dark Knight. Superman, we all know he crash-landed. Like, there's certain things that we all know. Okay, move forward. Move on with it. There's been enough stories written. I can't agree more with you. And unfortunately, it plays itself back in the comics. Now, one thing that the Shazam movie has done, so I'm going to give credit here, is it has brought a couple of people, mostly younger readers, I would say in the 8 to 12, 13 range, generally boys, come in and they ask for Shazam comics. And because of how our store is set up, we don't have as many of the more recent back issues out. We have more of the Bronze Age and back, or the key runs that are modern runs, so like the New 52 Scott Snyder Batman. That's kind of stuff we'd keep out. The Mark Waid Daredevil. But we don't have any of the more recent Shazam stuff, partially because we've got higher value books that take those spots, and partially because we don't get a lot of those because they weren't as popular. But we have a number of old Shazam issues. And we've had kids come in and say, you know, do you have Shazam? And we'll say, yep, we'll take them over and we'll show them the Shazam books. And they're like, he doesn't look quite the same. And we have a quick discussion to explain, you know, well, this is an older book. This is before, you know, it was created before the story that was being told in the movie was created. And every single one of those kids has said, oh, and they've taken the Shazam book, older one, they've read it, and they've come back and asked for more. And they say, we like this character better. Are they going to make a movie with this Shazam? And we're like, well, kind of can't do that. So I will say, in a backwards way, it has helped. It has worked. And much to our enjoyment, it has gotten these young new readers into the older material, which I think is great.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. I'm happy to hear that. I was afraid you were going to go with, oh, we're not interested in that one. We want the movie version.
No, believe it or not, they like the older one better. And I think it's because the older ones are pretty much done in one issues. And so they got a complete story out of it. They didn't have to go and seek a trade. Not like they'd find it anyways, because they're not really printed right now. But they didn't have to go and look for 12 issues or something. They could read a story and then be done. And then get another one and read a story and be done. And you can, with a couple of them, they've come in and I've been fortunate enough to be there. You see that little sparkle in their eye of excitement when they find a new issue. And they can't wait to get out of the store. They've already got it out of the bag and board. And they're reading it as mom or grandma or grandpa is walking them to the car to go home.
That's cool.
And so, I mean, that has worked. I just find it interesting because a lot of times with the Marvel TV shows, the Marvel movies, people come in and they say, I want the newest insert character name here. But with DC, we don't have a lot of Shazam. And what we do have that's coming out now is delayed. So at least it's driving them to something we do have.
It's a shame. And maybe they've done this and I'm unaware of it, but it's a shame they don't reprint like some of the Superman Shazam crossovers from DC Comics Presents. Or the some of the I know they've got in the Crisis on Multiple Earths stuff some of the JLA JSA crossovers that had the Shazam family in it.
Yeah, there's some of those that are still in print that they've got, but a lot of the stuff as you get older and older, there's just so much goofiness with the copyrights, and they aren't going to print if they don't think they're going to sell enough. And I mean, it was something that a lot of retailers were chiming in on. With DC was saying, you've got a big movie coming out, you've got posters everywhere. Yeah, it's not the Jeff Smith Shazam, but could you please print the older stuff too so that we've got more material to give out? Because I can only sell one Jeff Smith trade to each person.
Yeah. When there's not more of those stories out there, that's a problem.
Yeah, and we didn't really get anything else.
That's unfortunate.
Yep.
But I think that's the kind of thing, certainly on the trade side, that leads to Marvel doing better than DC a lot of times, although DC competes much better on the trade side. But I think it also bleeds into...
Not lately. Well, I'm going to tell you, not lately.
That's true. I mean, they did okay this month, but just barely. But I think some of that decision-making, though, is a lot of what's leading to not-so-great performance by DC on the comic side. They've got the talent. They've got, I think, the leadership, although they're not necessarily using the leadership right. I think they could beef up the editorial a little. But again, they've got strong people across the board. They're just not able to get the right take on the right characters. It's like they're just heading in the wrong direction, and I'm unclear why.
Yeah. So James and I had a little discussion about it. Was it last week, I want to say? And we were just kind of like kicking around, like, what doesn't feel right? And what we kind of settled on is that it feels like Marvel has in its what we're calling pockets. So the Avengers, Spider-Man, X-Men, inside those pockets, they have what appears to be some form of a direction that they're going.
Uh-huh.
Obviously the X-Men universe, you've got Hickman, you know, it has that feel. You go over to DC, and outside of Action and Superman and the Wonder Comics, which is all the Bendis stuff, it seems like everything is individually driven. it seems like the Batman title exists absent of Detective, outside of Batgirl, outside of Harley Quinn, outside of Batwoman. Each title is being driven solely by its creator. There doesn't seem to be a unified vision. And that's one of the things that we feel has been disjointing for readers. Now, you and James reviewed the Age of X-Men books, and you kind of both said the same thing, like, yeah, we read them. They weren't the greatest books, but we read them. We had people that came in, not really X-Men fans per se, historically by nature, mm-hmm. but they thought the fact that, you know what, these are contained together. There's a story that I can read that's obliquely related. To them, that was more valuable than four disparate titles all based in Gotham that DC's putting out.
And I can understand that, because one of the things I really enjoyed about Flashpoint is I thought during those 3 months, we got more exploration of that universe than I would argue we got in the New 52 over the first year across all of its titles.
Right.
So there's something to be said for having cross-title continuity, a cohesive vision, and a coordinated game plan.
That's one of those things that leading up to the New 52, the Green Lantern books that were just going crazy, because I think you had three titles going at the same time and they were all crossing over and people couldn't get enough of it. You got one, you wanted to get the other ones because it was all together and it was enough to really get you excited about these huge things that were happening. I mean, when you've got a line, you've got your Avengers books or your Spider-Man books, and they're all, they don't have to be telling the exact same story. But as long as you're referencing similar events, or you don't have Batman in three places at once, you know, or Thor fighting two people in two different sides of the universe at the same time while worrying yeah. about something, you know, if you're able to coordinate, and instead of it being an individual writer or whoever's decision, and you can step back and say, what's the whole picture we're trying to tell here? It just makes a lot more enjoyable consumption pattern.
Absolutely. It's not like these stories have to integrate with incredible precision, but they need to feel like they're happening in the same world at the same time and jive together, you know, and don't at least directly contradict each other.
Right, right. So I think that was kind of where we hit, where the bigger problem that we have with DC is that they don't even seem true to their own pockets of the DC Comics world.
If you want a good exploration of the difference between Marvel and DC, the place to go is the JLA Avengers crossover.
Oh, yeah.
Because it really puts some of that flat on the page. And where DC is the positive, more cheerful universe in some respects. And Marvel arguably is the more realistic, where there's disgruntledness and discrimination and that kind of stuff. But I think where DC is going wrong at the moment is they're not embracing the DNA of their universe, and they're trying to tell darker stories. They're trying to do the Year of the Villain. They're doing stuff like that, and it's, you can do that in the DC universe, absolutely, but when you go that whole hog on it, it's not what the DC universe kind of historically has been.
Right. No, I agree 100%, and I think part of that too was just based in the nature of DC was rooted in fictitious places, whereas Marvel, you were in New York. And as someone who frequents New York quite a bit now for work, you see the great, the bad, the in-between. You still see the segregation. You see, you know, patterns of behavior that aren't healthy. So, of course, it's going to make sense that Marvel's more rooted in what we would, I guess, term reality, whereas DC was more of that, generally speaking, that source of light. You know, Wonder Woman and Superman always kind of looking on the positive, trying to find the brighter. You kind of always had Batman who would have his brooding moments, but right now it can be a little depressing sometimes.
Well, I think there's power in stories that shine the light on the injustices of the world and show the darker, uglier side of things, which at times Marvel definitely does. You know, the whole racism with the X-Men mutants and stuff like that, I think is a good allegory and stuff. But there's also a type of story where you show the best man can be it kind of that utopic Star Trek future, or Superman is kind of the best of what a hero could be. Same with Wonder Woman. Even Batman, while he's a little in the grim and gritty at times, sometimes a lot in the grim and gritty, he's still showing that out of a harsh, you know, rough childhood with his parents dying in front of him, he could become the best man he could be.
Right.
Now, you can
do good for people.
To do good for people so they don't suffer like he did. Now, you can either tell that type of a story in the light of he is a better man for his tragedy, or he's a broken man because of his tragedy who's doing good, but man, he's messed up.
Right.
Those send very different messages. And they're going with the he's messed up route now versus if you look back in the 80s and kind of the some of that part of the Bronze Age and stuff, he was still a little messed up. He had a rough childhood, but he was well-adjusted. He could actually smile. He could get along with the Justice Leaguers. You know, there was a shiny brightness there that is just so missing, not only from the stories they're telling, but from the stories they want to be telling at DC these days.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
So, I mean, to your point, that DC is selling more units per item than Marvel right now. Definitely agree with that. That's definitely true. But I am under no delusion that DC could produce twice as many comics and then outsell Marvel. Because I don't think they got it in them to do that many more titles. And they should be able to.
I also think that part of it is Marvel is capitalizing on DC's struggles, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
I think they're looking at it and they're saying, hey, if they're not going to step up to the plate and they're leaving some market share, some dollars out there, what the heck? We can tell a story.
Well, and I think that's historically been part of Marvel's attitude of short-term gains. We'll deal with the long-term later. And in short-term, man, you pump out a five-issue miniseries in a five-week month, you get some sales. And there's a certain aspect of, and I heard this from a creator at Comic-Con, of comics are pulp entertainment. They don't need to be perfect. They need to be good enough. You get it, you pump it out, you get the next one done. And that creator has actually done some really great work, so I would not accuse this guy of just doing the bare minimum. But there's also a serious truth to the matter of comics should be coming out on a regular clip. This whole, oh, we got to wait for it to be perfect to release anything, kind of bogus.
Right.
You know, and it goes against the grain of how comics have been historically. Now, that's not to say since we've always done it that way, we always must do it that way. But there comes a time and a place of don't solicit the book until it's done. And there are some creators that I know do that. And there are others that, man, they'll solicit it. And then if it sells, they'll actually write the thing and put it out.
Right.
And I know which I respect more.
Yeah. And I think that to an extent, there's also a little bit of a work ethic change over time. And I'm not saying that in a bad way. I'm just saying that when comics were kind of in their heyday and were starting, the world was in a different place. America was in a different place. There was there was poverty, there was war, there was a lot of things going on. And if you can take yourself out of today and put yourself back in that time period, there weren't all the safety nets that we have today. And there was a lot more impetus on, I have to work. And I'm going to plug a different podcast. I don't listen to all of their episodes, but Comic Geek Speak, they do deep dives on certain things. And one of the ones that they've done is Jack Kirby. And one of the themes that continued to come up that they, through all their research and reading interviews and other texts on Kirby, one thing that continued to pop up was his continuance of saying, I have to provide for my family. I have to provide for my family. And when you're motivated by that, by survival, you can do amazing things. And I'm not saying that we should be at a point where comics are putting us in that position to create comics. We have to be in survival mode. But there's a difference of behavior. And when there's safety nets around you, when there's other opportunities, other things that you can do, you can write for television, you can write a blog, you can, you know, do whatever. Those are distractions. I'm not saying they're unhealthy, but they prevent you from getting your work done.
Well,
70 years ago, that wasn't the case.
Whenever you can just say, I'll get it done when I get it done, that changes the game significantly.
Exactly. And there's no real penalty.
There was a point in time where, you know, if that next issue of Shazam wasn't ready, the editor would just pull something out of his desk drawer. Sometimes I mean that literally. This is the inventory story we've got for Shazam. It's going as the next issue.
Right.
And you do that a time or two, and then sooner or later, it's like, well, do I keep working with this writer or this artist or whatever's the slow part in the chain?
Yep.
Not the case these days. And can't be the case these days, given the six-issue arc mentality. When right. you were pretty much telling done-in-one stories, you could do a filler. It's not that big of a deal. But I think that's one of those things where you were talking earlier about maybe storytelling structure needs to change. I absolutely think it does.
Yeah, and I think that, yes, you when you get a creator on a title, in good faith, you want to hope that that creator can have a run. I don't think a single person, a single comic book reader would say, I'm looking forward to a creator coming on a book for one issue. And when you get a creator on a title, you want to see them succeed. You want to see them do more than one issue if it's something you're looking forward to specifically. But the idea of, you know, a one, a two, maybe a three issue arc, or just write a book that you can read each issue independently or read them together and get a larger story. You just give yourself a lot more flexibility, both as a creator, as a publisher, and as a reader. You have a lot more, there's just a lot more you can do. So if you're an individual who's having, you know, you're in great health, but something all of a sudden comes up, if you've told the last piece of the story that you need to tell, and it was issue one or two, okay, you know what, we can put somebody else on for a couple months to let you get a chance to get back to where you need to be. But if you're on issue two of a six-issue arc, or God forbid, a 12-issue arc, well, now what do we do?
Well, and there have been times where that's happened, and somebody had to go do a fill-in story and put the ongoing story on pause for a few months, which kills its momentum when it comes back, because it's usually written as chapters of a serial book versus how the comics used to be told, where you could do a three-issue arc, you could do a five-part story or whatever, but each issue reintroduced enough of the crux of the story that somebody who hadn't read the previous stuff had a fighting chance to know what was going on.
Right.
You know, again, you look at some of those JLA-JSA crossovers and stuff, there was one that crossed over with All-Star Squadron, and it wasn't assuming by that fifth part that you'd read all four, or even by the third part you'd read all four. It's like, hey, let me tell you what you need to know. And again, every one of those stories, and they happened on a yearly basis, these JLA-JSA crossovers, everyone started with a page, or within the first few pages, had a page of, let me explain multiple worlds, because they were trying to be accessible. That's something that is lost on this day and age. I was reading a comic recently. It was one of the ones from H1 in their new line. It's the one where it's got the two people that can't be too far apart, or they explode, or something bad happens.
Yeah.
It was the second issue, and one of them was on a train, the other was not. And I'm trying to remember, okay, how did they get in this situation again? Because it was just presented of, here it is, let's go. Give me a memory jog. Help me out here. You know, it's, to me, there's, again, that goes back to storytelling style and structure that isn't that hard to give me a little bit of a ease me back into the story at the beginning of it kind of thing.
Right.
But you read it in trade, you don't notice because it's, you know, a page flip away. It comes down to, do you expect people to be binging your material or not? And if you're selling it in individual installments a month apart, you might want to assume they're not going to binge it. But that's just my theory.
No, I agree. I think I've said it a number of times now. Say it until I guess I can say it no longer, that one of the reasons why The Last Man is my favorite run is because each issue gives you some level of closure on the cliffhanger from the issue before, and you're left on a cliffhanger for the next issue. So it's not like the thread is hanging so far open, you know what's going on. I really find that to be something satisfying.
It's interesting because I think that can be satisfying. I think it would also be incredibly frustrating depending how well it's done.
Yes.
With New Teen Titans, and it may have been just New Titans at that point, with the Titans Hunt storyline, this is issue 80 or something. It was ways into it. Perez had already left the book, etc. Because I think it was issue 80 of the Baxter run. Anyways, Wolfman was still writing it, but it was one of those things where an issue would end on a cliffhanger, the next would pick up, resolve that, end on another, rinse, repeat. And it's like, every 20 pages, I'm getting to a massive cliffhanger kind of a deal. It's like, let's back off from the cliff, dude. So there are ways that can be done right. There are ways it could be done wrong. But either way, I think the point I took from what you were saying is if each issue has some sense of completeness to it and some sense of payoff to it, you're good.
Right. And there's times where you want to have that big cliffhanger where you don't want everything to be, you know, resolved.
Well, it's not that everything has to be resolved, but it's right. Something has to be resolved. So if you missed that issue, you missed the resolution of something.
Right.
And there's absolutely points where even if you've got payoff, 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 there's you do want to have that major cliffhanger of dun dun dun. Now what? You know, with the Super Sentai shows, almost every season that next to last episode ends with the team having just gotten trounced by the big bad of the season. Because then the next episode, they've got to pull it all together, show that they can still do it even though their Zords are destroyed or whatever, and save the day and be the heroes they are. It makes for the hero moment. So you need that big kind of major cliffhanger of, well, now what, to set that up.
Right.
But you do that each and every month, it doesn't quite work as well. I definitely think that there are storytelling techniques of the modern age that are leading to the apathy, the dropping of titles, and the short-lived titles, that if we were to compare today's storytelling to, say, like the 80s or something, where they're telling faster stories, shorter stories, even if they're multiple issues, there's still a difference in accessibility and enclosure per issue, that if those types of things were adopted today, I would like to think you could sell more comics. The risk is maybe that's just not what the audience today wants, but I would argue what we're giving them today isn't what they want either.
Yeah, and I think that that's the struggle is, somewhere along the line, people have decided, and the company that I work for was guilty of this for a number of years, they decided that, well, we're going to tell the customer what they want. You have a really hard time convincing a customer what they want. Usually they know what they want, hence why they're the customer. And I think that we're kind of at that point in comics where we're being told what we want, whether it's creative, editorial, publisher, I don't care. We're being told that this is what we want. And people are kind of saying, you know, no, it's not really what I want. I kind of like what's over there. And what's over there can be a TV show, can be manga, could be a novel, could be a Twitter feed. But there's something there.
Well, anytime you try to tell the customer this is what you want, you've already failed.
Exactly.
You've got to understand what they want. Better yet, you've got to understand why they want it to meet that need. But I think the other thing that makes today's comics fundamentally different from telling comics in the 80s, the 60s, or really any other point in the previous century, is right now comics' main competition are their own stories in other mediums.
Right.
People are happy to go take part of the Avengers through the movies. They want to experience The Flash. They'll watch TV. Hell, they want Batman. There have been plenty of great video games like Arkham City, Arkham Knight, whatever those were. You know, that people were raving over and such. And the same people who loved that, I wouldn't bother touching a comic. So you've got to not only, and this goes back to, it's not the characters, it's the stories you're telling. You know, if these were bad characters, we would not be having success with these characters in other mediums, either currently or in the past.
Correct.
So I definitely think that something needs to get shaken up over at DC. I think there are things Marvel's doing that are not necessarily great long term for the industry, but they're having success, so it's a little hard to argue with some of it.
Right.
But you know, if we actually flip over to the top comics and look at that number one item,
yeah,
Black Cat number one topped the list with 255,709 units. Over a quarter million units. Well, let's see. That first issue had a regular cover, 4 opened order variants, one of which was an Art Germ cover. It also had a 1 in 10, a 1 in 25, a 1 in 50, a 1 in 100, and a 1 in 200 cover.
Well, there are 3 reasons why. First, J. Scott Campbell cover.
That certainly helps.
Second, Art Germ cover.
Yep.
And third, if you exceeded 350% of your order for ASM16.hu, you got an extra 15% off.
So, yeah, you start piling on those kinds of promotional incentives, is going to do okay.
Yeah, and because of J. Scott Campbell and Archerm, we went in deep on it, and we're almost sold out. Like, I'm sorry, art sells. Well, at least covers sell.
Well, what's interesting is the second issue is going to have a regular cover, a single open-to-order variant with a carnage-dized theme, a 1 in 25 cover, a 1 in 50 cover, and a 1 in 100 cover.
Yep.
So half the variant covers. Sales are going to drop. It's still got the 1 in 100 cover, so they shouldn't, like, plummet. With the third issue, it's got the regular cover, a single open-to-order cover, a 1 in 25, a 1 in 50, a 1 in 100. So pretty much second and third have the same promotional cover gimmicks. I don't think we're going to see anything substantial there. It's just going to be kind of a regular second to third issue drop, minus whatever differences due to the art itself. You know, if that one in 100 is again a J-Stock candle, Art Germ, or some other big, you know, hot cover, that could play into it. Because sometimes having Art Germ or something makes the difference.
The 1 in 50 is a J. Scott Campbell Virgin, which is the A cover. This is for number 2. And the 1 in 100 is a Terry Dodson Hidden Gem.
Okay, so those will do pretty well. How about the third issue?
The third issue. Let me rechange my search to go to number 3.
Because it's got roughly the same kinds of covers, but if it doesn't have that caliber of artist on those covers, yeah, it's going to drop.
Ooh, yeah. So this is... the Black Cat number 3, 1 in 100, is the Campbell Virgin. There is a Jen Bartel, 1 in 25, and a Frank Cho, 1 in 50.
Okay, those are all pretty solid.
Yep.
So I could see potentially with the Cho, potentially it could even go up a little on the third then. By that fourth issue, Black Cat only has a regular cover. That's where we're going to see a drop.
I agree.
You know, it's... When you've got variant covers, the more the merrier, absolutely, it's going to goose sales. But it comes into what are the ratios? A 1 in 1 in 10 is going to do very differently than a 1 in 200, you know? But also, regardless of the ratios and whatnot, an Art Germ is going to do better than just some other cover by somebody.
Yeah, and to the ratio cover discussion, this is part of our frustration with DC. So when they were doing ratios before, it was typically like a 1 in 100, a 1 in 200. So if you think back to New 52, you had the Batman A cover, and then you had like the 1 in 100 or 1 or 200 Capullo black and white. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, that's great, but that really takes probably 80% of stores out of the mix of even being feasible to get that.
Yeah.
But the way Marvel does it, they've got a 1 in 10, 1 in 25. They put like an extra carrot just far enough out there that it makes you go, you know what, we might as well just order the extra 4 copies and get that bigger one that we know we can sell for at least ratio. You know, if it's a 1 in 25, we can sell for $25. And we've more than covered those 3 extra books. It works. And it works for us to sell extra, whether it's in the store, at a convention, on eBay, whatever. It works. And we've commented, you know, for certain DC launches, gee, it would be great if they would do a 1 in 25 and a 1 in 50. Because chances are we'd probably up our order from 32 copies to 50, but they don't. And to us, they are leaving that money on the table. Now, we've heard other retailers that say, you know, we don't like that you do these high ratios because it's unattainable for us to get them. And our response is then don't get them. Like, that's fine.
Yeah,
but for those of us that can and want to stretch a little farther, okay.
I can understand the complaint because there are going to be some consumers that got to have it, and if you're not a big enough store to get it to them, you could lose the customer. But I think when you just say, we're going to do variants, and it's only the 1 in 100, only the 1 in 200, to me, as a consumer, I find that frustrating because I've had years that I'm at San Diego Comic-Con, and I'm looking at some of the dealers that have the variant covers, and I'm like, what the hell was... Oh, I have read that title. I just had never seen any of those covers.
Right.
Because they just didn't make it to the store I was at, or I was mail order at the time, so I never saw them. I have long said and still believe that heavy reliance on variant covers is a potential risk for the industry, and therefore a potentially an incredibly bad thing. Because if that market dries up, it could dry up very quickly and very devastatingly for the industry. We have seen this happen in the past. That having been said, were I to publish comics, would I do a variant cover? I'd certainly consider it. To your point, you're leaving money on the table if you don't. The question is, can you find a way to do it that gives you the sales boost you either need or want and do it in a way that seems equitable to everyone involved and not like, yeah, I'm doing a 1 in 1,000, you know? Who the hell's going to be able to order that? I mean, come on.
There's some stores that are crazy enough to do it. I might know one. We might have done it in the past.
Yeah, but...
But not everyone can. It's a serious investment. It's an investment of dollars, and it's an investment of energy, because the minute you commit to doing that, you're working your fanny off to pre-sell as much as you can.
Yeah. And from a publisher point of view, you now have data that is irrelevant to projecting how the next issue is going to sell. So from a publisher point of view, and this is where I think incentive covers are really risky for the industry. Companies are making print runs based on how they think they can sell. That includes how many they think they can sell to the variant covers. That market dries up as the speculator bust had happened in the 90s and stuff. That happens again. Suddenly, they've outlaid a bunch of money to print a bunch of covers that nobody's, at some point in time, theoretically, not going to need, want, or be able to buy. And that's cash that's kind of pulled out of the system. Now, if that happens hard enough and fast enough, it starts taking either publishers and or retailers out. That reverberates back and forth through the industry. When it happened last time, we had multiple distributors to kind of share the load. Now we've got a single point of failure with Diamond. And if they get stuck in the middle with publishers that can't produce because they're out of money or retailers that can't pay because they're out of money, that hurts Diamond and that can't help anybody. So I think there's massive risk, but it's one of those things that medicine can be deadly in too high of a dose. You use it in incremental, small managed amounts, you can do fine with it. I just don't know that these publishers are doing that kind of incremental, slow managed amounts. You know, when I see about a dozen variant covers slapped on a single comic, I start to wonder, really, you know, do you need that many?
Yeah, and I think it depends how they're applied. Marvel has gotten rid of the, you know, unlock this one by ordering 90% of this book and 125% of that book. And they've gotten rid of all of that stuff, which is something that retailers complained about and they listened. But I think that by and large, the way that Marvel is doing their variants now, 1 in 500, 1 in 1,000, and 1 in 2,000 aside, or the Darth Maul 1 in 5,000 or something it was. Jeez. All of that stuff aside, by and large, the way that they do it is in my books, it's relatively sustainable from the standpoint of outside of their issue ones. A lot of their books, Black Cat is an outlier. Most of their books don't have anything beyond a 1 in 25 after that. Or if they do, it's a bigger book like a Conan. Yeah. That's still selling really well, and they may do a 1 in 50 and a 1 in 25.
Well, typically they ramp back pretty fast after that first issue.
Right.
But that's also why we tend to see the big drops on the second issue.
Right, and Marvel's philosophy is they're going to dangle that carrot. Again, they kind of have an idea if you're ordering, you know, they're going to leave, like for Conan, they're going to leave that 1 in 50 and that 1 in 25 out there for an issue or two because they know they're going to get high orders for the first one. And then as they start to see the numbers go down, they'll know and they'll look and kind of say, well, you know, an average order is about 20 or 22. Well, we might as well keep the 1 in 25 on there, get them to bump a couple more copies. And it works. It's a way of getting a couple more copies on the shelf. It's something that the Conan collector likes. It's something that the retailer who can get it likes. So they do it respectfully. And the one thing that Marvel has also been really good at is if we as retailers start to see a book getting hot, getting like the Immortal Hulk, if we're starting to see things that all of a sudden are taking off and they put a 1 in 25 and we're getting a bunch of orders and we say, hey, you know, we've got 4 orders for the 1 in 25. Can you do a 1 in 50 version? By and large, there's enough retailers that are chiming in saying the same thing, like this thing's selling like hotcakes. If you got one more to throw on top. And at that point, it's really Marvel saying, yeah, we're going to throw you guys as retailers a bone. Because if I've got 4 people ordering a 1 in 25, having them throw a 1 in 50 or a 1 in 100 virgin cover, I'm not buying a single extra copy of the A. I'm just getting an extra variant. And so that's a way they're paying back to the retailers to say, hey, you guys are, you know, success continues to trickle down. So let's get you guys something extra. And that's one thing Marvel's doing that DC doesn't.
Well, and that's effectively rewarding people for buying more. And I'm good with that. I think that's beneficial. And I'm even okay with the, hey, if the average store is getting 22, let's put a 1 in 25 out there. Because at that point, you're just trying to get a little bit of an incremental boost.
Right.
Okay. Now, if it's the average order is 22 and we're going to do a 1 in 50, that I wouldn't be so keen on because it's like, come on.
And that happens, and that's very seldom does it happen, and it's a book that's usually very underordered. And at times when that happens, that variant becomes very expensive, and it's one of those things where, you know, we usually don't see it again. So like if you see a 1 in 50 – that's incredibly underordered. Usually the next issue is not going to have the 1 in 50 because the numbers came in and Marvel's going to say, well, 50 clearly didn't do anything. It just, you know, the 5 accounts that could get it, got it.
Yeah.
So they're smart enough to dial it back. So while it can be frustrating, I think that by and large, Marvel's practice is, it's pretty well calculated. They know what they're doing. They've done it long enough. They listen to the retailers. They see our orders. They know what's going on.
Well, and the fact that they've been phasing out the meet or exceed ones, I appreciate that too. Now, I do think, though, if you're going to do some of these kinds of promotional pushes, particularly not on first issues, and sometimes they'll do it on I don't want to say a key issue, but on a later issue. If you're going to do that, I think you really need to coordinate that with the creative team so they know ahead of time and they can work on making that issue a little bit more accessible than the average.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very fair comment that I think could use some work.
Because when I think back on some of these kind of what gimmicks have they done that really goose the sales of particular comics, there's a lot of ones like, was it Civil War or Secret War? Civil War, where a crossover with that would kick a title 2, 3, 4 times the sales. Okay, that's part of a crossover. That's a different thing. But the other one that I saw that was part of a crossover but boosted DC Comics, certain books, 5 or 6 times almost what they'd been selling, was when they gave out those plastic power rings tying in with the Darkest Night stuff.
Yep.
Now, if they had made those issues that they were given away with so accessible, maybe even a little oversized, something to where, man, you read that, if you could be hooked, you would be hooked. That's the kind of story you want to tell in those issues.
Right.
And it was just kind of another run-of-the-mill story, as I recall. The fact that I don't recall clearly says something. So if you're going to do those kinds of promotions, there's ways you can leverage it better based on the content of the story and get more bang for the buck that has a better chance of actually getting you renewed interest in the next issue.
Right.
But that's a little harder to do. If we look at the number 2 item on the list, we've got Deceased number 2. That's down 37.34%, which...
Still a good number, though, 152,000.
Yeah, I was going to say, given how high it was selling before, it was going to go down.
Yeah.
You know, and the fact that it's still... I mean, if it hadn't been for Black Cat and its incentives and stuff, this obviously would have topped the list or whatever. Tom Taylor, they're doing well with this. I'll be curious if they've got a game plan for after this is over, if we get a Deceased 2 or something. Don't know. After that, we've got Silver Surfer Black, number 1, 129,490 units.
Yep, this one also had a deep discount. If you ordered 300% or more of Guardians of the Galaxy, number 5, you got an extra 15% off. And they had tiers for 5 and 10% too, but I'm just going to the farthest one.
That one had a regular cover, an open-to-order cover, a 1 in 50 cover, and a 1 in 100 cover. The 2nd, 3rd, and 4th issues each have a regular cover, an open-to-order cover, and a 1 in 25 cover. Mm-hmm. So I expect to see a bit of a drop on the 2nd issue, but then kind of the standard attrition from there.
Yeah, this is a book that actually came out with a lot of excitement. The 1st issue is onto its 3rd print already. And it's something that we've gotten a lot of buzz in the store with. It's Donnie Cates, and people like the Tradmore art, so... Seems to be something that's resonating well with readers.
Well, and you got to commend Marvel for actually getting the reprints out there.
Oh yeah, I mean I don't think merciless is the right word, but they sure are. They're Bible thumpers when it comes to the reprints. They are quick to pull triggers. I mean, every week when I'm sending out an FOC order, there's at least a handful of Marvel 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th printings on there.
There was a point. I'm trying to think how long ago it was. It might have been 10, 15 years, where they were so much pounding the drum of order it now, we're not reprinting a damn thing. And it was almost scare tactics. And there's a power to that, but I think this is the better approach.
I agree, and DC has taken that approach of final printings, and it's really annoying because sometimes you just can't find your ceiling.
Compare, though, that approach to, hey, you ordered what you ordered and you're stuck. With Immortal Hulk being a success, multiple printings of those earlier issues, and now director cut versions of those earlier issues.
Yep.
I mean, they're finding new ways to cash in on the success of the title, and that's great.
And the other thing that, believe it or not, does help is putting different cover art on it, not doing the DC recolor the cover nonsense, because if it's got new cover art, take Naomi, for example, which went to a second print and then a third final print. If they had drawn a new cover for Naomi for the third cover, instead of ordering in a dozen of them, I probably would have gotten orders for close to double or triple that. And yes, it's people, speculators buying it. It's completionists wanting it. But it's also more appealing to the eye. And when you see a book that has a different cover, you can tell. A recolored cover is usually a little more muted, a little bit more dull. It doesn't stand out. It's not as exciting. And I'm sorry, Marvel has it figured out. They just have it figured out.
Yeah. Again, I see both sides of this one, because I agree with you. If it's got a new cover, eyes are going to be attracted to it of, hey, I haven't seen that. Oh, well, maybe it's a reprint, or I didn't catch it the first time, I'll get it now, or whatever. But if it's just, I've seen that and it looks a little different, oh, they've just recolored the logo a little, everyone's unimpressed by that.
Yep.
It used to be easier when I was a kid to know if I had an issue by looking at the cover. Not so much these days.
I think the other thing with the retouch is when you've got people that are coming in looking for a book, especially a book you're trying to find and you have to order subsequent issues, if they go out and they look at the website and they see the full color, regular cover of Naomi, and they come into your store and they say, I'm looking for Naomi 1, and you take them to a subsequent print that has a recolored cover, they look at it and they go, that doesn't look right. The one that I see on the picture looks different than this. And you say, well, this is a later printing, and it sets them off right then and there.
It feels like a bait and switch at that point.
It feels like they're missing something. It's not complete. It's not whole. It's not right.
Yeah, I can see that.
It's weird how it works, but that's the reaction we've gotten.
Well, and Marvel clearly understands that psychology of the reader better than DC.
Yeah.
Interesting. Good, though, to have the problem of how to sell, you know, subsequent printings of comics. Because so many go out there, barely sell the first printing, and nobody gives a damn after that.
Yeah, I think, personally for me, if publishers backed their product the way that they want us to back their product, they'd print more and have it at the Diamond Warehouse. We wouldn't have to go so deep on printings on some of these things.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way I look at it personally. I mean, if they thought that the product was good enough to put out, and they think it's good enough to sell after the week that it comes out, then they would stock more.
Well, they would take a little bit more of the risk on their side,
right?
And not just berate you for not having ordered enough, or wait until the back orders get high enough to justify another printing.
Yeah, or give me the line of, this is your final printing, you don't order it now, you're not going to have any more. Well, all right, don't plan on me ordering any more in the future either, then.
Yeah, if you don't want the money, I can't give it to you, kind of thing.
Yep.
It's bad sales technique of, you want it, but I'm not going to sell it to you. That one's never made sense to me. Let's see. We've got Batman Damned number 3. It did 115,414 units. We've also got Batman Who Laughs number 6. 98,353 units. It is worth pointing out that we do not have Doomsday Clock or Batman Last Night on Earth in June.
Correct.
Now, that resulted, based on the previous month's sales, of a deficit of about 231,535 units in June for DC from those titles not having shipped. Now, that puts their DC's month-to-month drop of 394,357 units into a bit more of perspective, since well over half of that is just two comics that didn't ship.
Right.
Now, whether they were scheduled to ship or not ultimately doesn't matter. They weren't there in June, you know? If they had actually gotten those out, they'd have been up for the month.
Right.
So, and Batman Damned ended with number 3, so that's right there, 115,000 deficit going into the next month for DC, and we're only a few items down on the list.
Yeah, and I mean, you go just a little bit farther than that, and this totally illustrates the point that I made earlier, that the boutique DC titles are outdoing everything else that DC really has. You've got your Batman Damned, your Batman Who Laughs, your Superman Year One. You know, these are things that are not, they're not going to last. They're not going to hang around. They're not core titles. They're just a boutique offering, and people are more interested in that than your mainline superhero universe.
Well, let's filter the list just for a minute to just DC, and let's look at the stuff over 50,000.
Right.
We've talked about Deceased, we've talked about Batman Damned, we've talked about Batman Who Laughs. Batman 73 sold 81,919 units. 72 of Batman sold 80,585 units. Superman Year One, that goes again to your kind of boutique title thing, 80,103 units. Event Leviathan, 74,007 units. That's, well, it says right there, it's an event. It must be an event. We've got Detective Comics, 1,005, 1,006. One's doing a little above 60,000. The other's doing a little above 59,000. We then get Justice League 25 at 75,000 and change, and 26 at 52,724. And that's it for above 50,000.
Yep.
You know, we get a little below, we start hitting Superman, Green Lantern, Action Comics, Catwoman. By the time we hit Flash, we're just a little above 40,000, then just a little below 40,000. So you've only got a handful of titles that are really doing well. And again, a lot of those, to your point, are those kind of, you know, offshoot, short-lived boutique titles, as you were calling them. That's not a great way to build up a powerful line of comics.
It's a warning sign. And the other thing that I wonder is, as we close in on the end of Tom King's run on Batman, is will it dip below 75,000? I mean, it was almost unfathomable during New 52 to ever think that Batman would go under 100. And then we got into the Rebirth Batman, and we thought, well, there's no way it's going to go under 90. And now here we are on Batman issue 72 and 73, and we're in the low 80s, like 80,500 and 81,900.
I think if Tom King's run plays out for the 12 issues that's after 75, it not only will go under 75,000, it'll go under 70,000. I don't think it's out of the question to wonder if it'll go below 65,000.
That would just be amazing. And not in a good way, obviously. If that isn't warning signs.
That's when you know you've had a creator that it's not that he's been on the title too long. It's that he's been telling a story too slow.
Or just what he's telling isn't resonating with readers.
Fair enough. Something of that sort.
And I think that that's more what it is than anything. And it's a really polarizing, honestly. We have people that are like, you know, I'm loving it. And we have people that are like, I can't do it anymore. I have to drop it. And we don't have anyone really in the middle that's like, it's okay. It's either you get it, you click with it, or you just don't want anything to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, Heroes in Crisis, which is on the list. Is it on here somewhere? Well, it ended, I guess, last month with and added to DC's deficit of 77,861 units going into June. So again, between that, Doomsday Clock, and Batman Last Night on Earth, we're at over a 30,000 unit deficit for DC going into the month. And again, that's about what the entire month was down this time around.
Right.
But they're going to pull out of Heroes in Crisis. They're going to do Flash Forward, a Harley and Ivy title, continuing those story aspects. And I'm like, I'm curious how those are going to do. Because I think Tom King is an incredibly polarizing writer. Like you said, some people love him, some people hate him. I'm not on the love side, unfortunately. I wish I could say...
It's like Grant Morrison. I mean, you've got people that love Morrison, people that can't stand Morrison. I mean, it's no different.
For me, Morrison has kind of some of his stuff I love, some of it I hate, whereas it's getting to where pretty much everything by Tom King I'm not loving. But it's making me wonder, am I part of that target audience DC's trying to hit these days? And I'm increasingly of the opinion that I must not be.
And for us as retailers, we want DC to articulate to us, who is your core audience that you're trying to go to?
Yeah.
Because they can't articulate that to us. And their titles certainly can't articulate it to us. I mean, we're looking at, you've got, well, the former DC Inc. and DC Zoom, and you've got the DC Superhero Girls books. There's so much. And I think that that's one thing where originally when it came out that the Marvel Action, the kids line of Marvel books is going to IDW, a lot of people were like, well, why would Marvel do that? Well, you know what? Seems to make a lot of sense because there's no real question of what Marvel's trying to sell.
They're clearly aiming those at a different audience.
Right. And they've said, you know what? We don't want to muddy the waters of Marvel. So we'll let IDW handle this. And I kind of have to, originally I was like, this doesn't make sense. Now I get it. I see it. It makes sense.
It's giving the audience a lot of credit for brand awareness in a way that I'm not sure all of the audience has. Everyone, I think, listening to this podcast probably does, because I would say they're the serious comic fans. Casual comic fans, and depending how casual, I had a coworker on my last job that was confused that the Ultimate Spider-Man was featuring, that title was featuring a different Spider-Man than in Peter Parker, Spectacular, Amazing, etc. That's just another adjective.
Well, I guess I look at it this way too, from the Marvel standpoint with their Marvel Action at IDW, the risk isn't on Marvel. They've got no skin in the game. IDW is doing the creative. IDW is publishing it. IDW is selling it. If IDW tanks, Marvel says, that's fine. That's not our core line of what we're trying to do. We didn't need it to begin with. Otherwise, we'd be doing it.
I would imagine that they're getting a license, a royalty fee, whatever. So they've got a certain guaranteed income.
They're just getting bonus money.
Yeah. The only potential risk is if it were to damage the IP somehow, and I've got to imagine they've got enough checks and balances in place to prevent that from happening. You don't license a book out without some sort of oversight as to the content. So it does seem like it's low to no risk for Marvel.
Right.
Now, whether that's ever going to be something where we hear a decade or two from now, oh yeah, I got into Marvel through those IDW ones and loved that and then graduated to the Marvel books, etc. I don't know. Maybe we'll see that, maybe we won't. But, I mean, how many people have we heard got into the X-Men through the 90s cartoon or through the movies or something like that? It does happen.
Right.
So if they can grow a new audience that way, that's good for everybody.
Oh, yeah. I don't disagree. I just think you can definitely see a difference right there from the publishers of Marvel saying, we know who we are. We know who our core audience is. They're that teen plus and up. And we're, you know, we do the realistic and sometimes grim and gritty street level Marvel superheroes, and we're okay with that. We know that's our identity and that's what we're going to do.
Yeah. I do think, though, the problem of not knowing who your target audience is massive throughout the comic industry. I think if you were to ask most people, who are you selling to? Well, I'm selling to comic fans who buy comics at comic stores. Okay. It's like targeting a movie to people who watch movies.
Yeah, right.
That's pretty damn broad. Not only is this my opinion, I actually read a book recently, granted it was published in, I think, 2012-ish, of Comic Book Marketing 101. It was a thing I found on Kindle for, it might have been on Kindle Unlimited, whatever, but it was pretty harsh in terms of how well they thought comics were marketed, at least at the time. And if the guy's facts are accurate, and I see no reason to think they are not, I think he had a pretty accurate assessment.
Let me guess. Not well.
Nah. He did some basic tests of, okay, here's some licensed properties. How well are they marketing them? How are they trying to tap into the non-comic reader fan base? Not at all.
Right. We'll get the non-comic reader in merchandising.
Well, it'd be like using they've got in the latest previews Buffy Angel Hellmouth crossover thing. If you're selling that to Buffy fans, that's very different than selling it to Buffy fans that happen to already be comic fans already in the comic store.
Right.
One's a much bigger audience than the other. So there are better ways to sell this stuff than is often being done. So I think that's why we're seeing, really, once you get out of the top 25, again, we're below 50,000 units. I don't think 50,000 units is a particularly high bar to achieve, but maybe it is. I don't know.
Well, you know, achieve versus sustain, I think, is a distinction that I would make. I don't think it's hard to get over 50,000 if three publishers, at least on an initial out or a relatively new title, but to sustain it, that's where you have the trouble.
Let's split the field in two. There's Marvel, DC, there's everybody else.
Okay.
For Marvel, DC, they should not have a problem sustaining a title. Certainly above 40,000, I would say a strong title, it should be able to sustain above 50,000.
Right.
And right now, if you look what they've got above 50,000 between those two publishers, and you take out limited series, event series, boutique series type stuff, we're talking Amazing Spider-Man, Immortal Hulk, Batman, too early for Savage Avengers, maybe, maybe not, Detective Comics, Justice League,
Venom.
Yeah, and Uncanny X-Men.
Which is now over.
Well, actually, that was issue 19. Issue 20 is down at 41,199.
Yep.
So it was down, what, 1,000 units between the two, thereabouts?
10,000.
10,000, yeah. Can't do the math.
Slight order of magnitude.
Yeah, so that's 20% drop between those two. That's pretty significant. So when you've only got a few titles out of, what did we say, 150 items between Marvel and DC? Just through dumb luck, I would hope you could do better. 50,000, that is, what, 20% of what would have been cancellation figures back in the 80s? Granted, we're a generation later and apparently nobody knows how to read anymore, but still, there's pretty pictures to look at.
I think part of it, too, just has to go with, fortunately or unfortunately, how comic books are sold. I can't help but every time I go in the grocery store feel sad that they're not on shelves there.
They're not on shelves there. They're costing, what, 10 times as much as they were back when they were on shelves there in the 80s. So absolutely, there's tons of aspects about how comics are sold that are not helping. The pre-order aspect, the price point, the partial story installments, that you have to go hunt for the store. And even then, they may not have what you want, depending how well they could guess a few months in advance. So definitely, I think there are things that make selling comics a lot harder than it has to be. But while that system needs to change, I don't think it's a system that can change rapidly. One, because it's a big train to move. And two, I think too rapid of a change could derail it. And I don't know that anyone knows what the replacement system ought to look like, much less could agree on that. But something needs to happen. So what else looked interesting to you this time around?
Well, let's get my lists all filtered back to where they started.
What did you think of the sales of War of the Realms? Issue 6 was at 68,965 units. This seems like an actual legit Marvel event, and doing under 70,000 is not impressive.
So I agree with you. Yes, doing under 70,000 is not impressive, but I will counter with considering that everything above it from Marvel is either an issue 1 or Amazing Spider-Man. I think you want to see that your event title is one of the highest titles that you're selling. And it was one that we sold more of than most any other Marvel issues as well.
So your point is perspective. Are you looking at the raw numbers or looking where it does relative to everyone else? And that's a fair point.
Yeah. And so, I mean, to an extent, you almost have to take numbers out, so to speak, and really just look at what's selling around. And that's kind of where my boutique title with DC thing came from, is looking at what's selling around you. And ASM, of course, is going to always be kind of a leader in sales for Marvel, or at least it has been for a significant amount of time since James and I have had the store. So to be selling up there just shy of the ASM numbers is, while you want to see it selling more, considering there's nothing else above it, it's not out of the question for us. Savage Avengers number 2 was selling under War of the Realms, and that had at least a 1 in 50 variant on it. So you can see that War of the Realms having kind of its position in the universe, it's done well, I think, relative.
Relative, but many past Marvel events have done like 2, 3, or 4 times as well as this.
Sure. Oh, and I mean, you can say the same thing about DC events, and I think it's just a factor of the time. And so I think what you want to do is just look at it relative to those other titles to understand, how is it selling off of your shelves? Is it selling equal to the best titles, or is it selling, you know, an order of magnitude under? And if it's an order of magnitude under, that's a big problem.
I guess part of what I'm saying is the benchmark I would use is sometimes it's selling that order of magnitude above your best title.
Sure. And then in that case, it's a home run.
Yeah. I mean, that's how Civil War had been and stuff like that. So I don't know if they've gone to bat too many times with this, or there are too many events going on, or is it just general apathy? It did not do poorly relative to their other titles, but compared to, well, again, they did have something to hit over, you know, 250,000 units this month with Black Cat. Yes, it was number one. Yes, there were all the sales incentives, but it's not like that number of units is unattainable.
Yeah, and I think part of it also had to do with just the core construct of what it was. Even if you are the most ignorant person in the world, if you're kind of forced to, say, choose an event to read, and one of them is something called War of the Realms that kind of deals with not necessarily your number one top tier character or two, or you could look at an event that has to deal with Iron Man and Captain America. You kind of...
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's a difference there. It's, I don't know.
Well, certainly who you have anchor the event is going to color it.
Exactly.
You know, nobody really expected Blackest Night to do so well because it was really the first kind of Green Lantern event to speak of. Yet it was really well done, so it did do well. But they also did a lot of promotional gimmicks. Again, the plastic rings, etc. was part of it. You look at some of the events at Marvel that have done really, really well. To your point, Iron Man, Captain America, Wolverine, other key characters were at the linchpin of it.
Thanos.
Yes. Matter of fact, Thanos can account for, go back far enough, probably at least 6 or 7 different events easily.
Right.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, and that's kind of, I think, what you look for when you look at an event is, what is it really structured around? Like, who are your core characters? Because if it is a top-tier set of characters that have a large sway across your universe, then you know that the event is going to carry a lot of weight. When it's maybe like a A-minus or B-plus level character, maybe it isn't just, you're kind of like, well, it's an A-minus B-plus kind of event. It's not as big of an event.
Well, I would argue for Heroes Reborn, the main lead top character that was in most of the book was Harley Quinn, because Wally West hasn't had a title in ages.
Heroes in Crisis?
Heroes in Crisis, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
Booster Gold really hasn't sustained a title for a while.
Right.
Batgirl has a title, but let's see, how did she do this month? Where is Batgirl? It's around here somewhere. Am I just not going far enough down? I may not be going far enough down.
I'm going to go ahead and try and filter.
You're smarter than I am.
Oh, there's no Batgirl on the list.
Oh, there's no Batgirl on the list? Did it skip that month?
She must have taken a month off.
Must have. For shame. So no easy way to see how she did that month. Let me go pull up a quick chart to see how her title is doing. But even so, she was not central to the plot.
And Harley's at 27,500.
But also has TV, movie, etc. Batgirl's been doing upper 25 to 30,000 to 38,000. Over the last year.
Yeah, so just maybe a hair ahead of Harley.
Yeah, but when you've got things that are doing around that 30,000 range and say, you know what, we're going to anchor them as the key parts of an event book, you can't expect it to do the quarter million units or something.
Yep,
Not that I think a DC event has ever really done the quarter million units.
Well, if you count a one-issue rebirth, by the time all those reorders got done...
The Rebirth Special is an interesting one because it was an event comic, but by definition, it couldn't be an event series.
Right.
So it's one of those neither fish nor fowl, but it's certainly, well, and part of it is DC doing this slow burn meta arc over the span of years, I think is frankly part of their problem.
Oh, how did Flashpoint sell? Was that in the 150s?
That's a great question. Let me check. I don't remember. I'm going to have it chart everything for Flashpoint except Venom Flashpoint, because I'm pretty sure that doesn't count. It did, the main series started at 59,845, arced down and ended at 99,519 with the last issue upswing of considerable amount. The low point was actually issue 3 with 86,007 units.
And what did the first issue start at?
It started at 95,845.
So it never cracked 100.
Never cracked 100. It came really close at the end.
If they had just had that ratio variant.
Well, or if we were to look at how it may have done under the radar of the top 300 afterwards.
Sure. Or relative to the top performing DC books.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is at the time.
Yeah, they were doing all the miniseries and
the top performing, because all the miniseries tended to start between like 30,000 and 50,000 and all ended between say 20,000 and 40,000.
Right.
But it was an odd time for the DC universe because everything immediately prior to Flashpoint was seen as lame duck titles of, well, they're killing the whole universe. Who cares?
Yep.
These things were kind of sort of both an event and lame duck titles at the same time.
Because they knew that you knew that something was coming after it anyways.
Yeah, it's two, three issues. Who cares? And then we got the new 52. So this to me was for the hardcore DC fans. I question how well they could pull something like that off now, not only after Flashpoint, but after Convergence, and after, I think, the increased apathy around the DC universe.
Yeah. Yeah, we won't even go into Convergence. We'll just let that be a two-month period of time that existed in some other plane of reality.
Yet parts of it have had a huge impact on the DC universe. And specifically, that's where we got the current Superman, Lois Lane, and John Kent.
Yep.
So, it's not like it's gone and forgotten.
Well, it's a shame because most of it was forgotten before it even arrived.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was not good for sales and for DC readership.
Well, because it's a two-month bump in the road. That goes back to the comment we had earlier. If you've got somebody telling a 12-issue story and you pause it for 2 months, what happens?
Right.
If you've got people in the universe and you pause it for 3 months, what happens? People bail out. I often question how much these publishers and creators understand the reader mentality and how easy it is to get somebody off a title and how much harder it is to get somebody on the title.
Yes. Off ramps are always easier to find.
Yeah. It's sales go down. It's a force of gravity. You know, you've got to defy that to get them up. Such as down at rank 82, Nightwing 61 is at 22,621 units. That's going to be hard for them to recover from if and when they finally decide to get past the current Nightwing's plural storyline. So I'm not sure if they've got a game plan for that title.
Part of me wonders why editorial allowed that direction, because we saw how well We Are Robin or We Are the Robins. We saw how well that worked out.
Yeah, but I think Dan DiDio's got a long track record of not liking Nightwing.
Yeah, he doesn't like sidekicks. Especially Dick Grayson.
I don't get it, because to me that's fighting the DNA of the universe you're in. Sidekicks are part and parcel of the DC universe in a way they are not over in the Marvel universe.
And, you know, I hate to say it, but Dick Grayson's been around a little while.
Been around forever. If you discount Bucky and Toro, can you name any other sidekicks in the Marvel universe? I'm sure there are some, but none that come to my mind immediately, whereas I could probably rattle off a few dozen over at DC.
I mean, you know, about the only one that I can think of, and it's not even really a sidekick per se, is Foggy.
That's comedic best friend. That's like a supporting cast like Jimmy Olsen.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's about the best I can do.
But Captain America had Bucky as his sidekick. That's a legit sidekick, I'll grant that. Toro was the sidekick of the original Human Torch. I'll grant that. Both happened to be members of the Invaders. Again, going back to the 40s. All the characters, though, that spawned out of the 60s, the real resurgence of and creation of the foundation of the Marvel Universe, I would be hard-pressed to name any actual true sidekick.
Well, and, you know, Batman started in Detective 27, and it was only 11 issues of Detective Comics later that the Boy Wonder appeared.
Yeah. So, again, that's foundational aspect of the DC Universe. Whether you like the idea personally or not, it's part of the universe you're playing with DC, so embrace it and leverage it. Tell stories that Marvel simply cannot.
Right.
When they're doing something like Champions, which is apparently going to end with issue 10, they're doing it with young characters, but virtually none of them are true sidekicks. So embrace that difference and actually have a team of Teen Titans that are sidekicks, not just younger versions of characters, which is what they're doing.
Correct.
Now, just for reference, Champions number 6 is down at rank 105 at 19,921 units. So you were saying a month or two back that you thought 15,000 was sustainable sales. This looks to be a case where it's doing over that and Marvel's deciding not to continue for whatever reason. And it may not be sales that they made the decision.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of those ones where we don't really know the story yet. It could be any one of a number of different things. It could be the characters being used somewhere else. It could be that Jim Zub's got something else that he needs to do. Who knows?
From what I was hearing, it didn't sound like it was Zub's decision. It sounded like he wanted to do more, but Marvel made the decision not to keep going. Now, I just did a quick chart of Champions, and I need to go dig up what happened at the beginning of the 2016 run of it, because my chart is telling me, and I'm assuming this is wrong, but it may be legit, I'd have to go look, that it started, or accumulated sales for that first thing, of 334,937 units. And then went down to 50,000 and stayed under there for the entire run. Did they do some crazy gimmick on that first issue? That would have been October 2016. Because I see numbers like that, and I simply do not believe. I'm pulling up the spreadsheet for that month.
I do not believe either.
Actually, I've got Champions number one having sold 328,165 units.
I'm trying to get there as to why. That's the 2019 one. The Diamond site is not always the most elegant.
Mark Waid, Humberto Ramos, so good creative team, but not, you know, 328,000 good creative team. I mean, nobody's that.
I've okay.
Got to so, imagine variant covers.
Champions number one. This was October 5th, 2016. Good God, look at all those covers. Party sketch cover. One in 1,000.
Yeah.
Deadpool 1 in 1,000 variant.
So, uber crazy variants, and that made it sell better than what, the next five issues put together? Easily. By five issues in, it was down at 30,000.
Premium, one per store. Exceed 200% of all new, all different Avengers. Exceed 200% of all new, all different Avengers. Exceed 200% of all new, all different Avengers. One in 50. C200.
I mean, to me, that's just an example of how you can really goose the sales if you need to or want to with variant covers.
Ooh, 1 in 100 Ross. Okay. Yeah, there's quite a few covers there.
Yeah. All right, so my charting was good.
Yep.
But this is where I need to find a way to have it magically annotate what the hell happened with some of those crazy things.
Let's see here. Oh, yeah. I was looking at weeks late. I was just kind of goofing around seeing, you know, what was significantly late. And
what are you using as a definition of significantly?
Yeah, so I started with 12 weeks late. There's no 12, so it was 13 or greater.
I thought there was one that was 12 weeks late.
I see an 11 and a 10, because I filtered on column AB.
Oh, that's weeks since previous issue. As terms of weeks late, we had 12 for Lab Raider number 1. First issue being that late is pretty bad. Thief of Thieves 43 was 29 weeks late. Vampirella Rose for the Dead was 37 weeks late. So yeah, there's some significant ones.
Yeah, you got an IDW Marvel Action Spider-Man number 5 was 13 weeks late.
That surprises me the most is Knights of the Dinner Table number 265 being 13 weeks late. Only 10 since the previous issue, but that I always thought came out pretty much like clockwork. Wonder what happened there. I'd have to go dig into that. That's very much an oddball kind of a title.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just such a unique thing, because it's more magazine than traditional comic, and what it has in there I would term more as epic form comic strips. And that's been a title that, again, is more for the game stores than the comic stores. But back at the beginning of my data, it was selling around 7,000 units, and last we saw it, It was doing here 1,939 units.
It did 1,939 this month and 1,100 the previous, or issue, I should
yeah,
say.
Yeah, yeah.
So, up.
But that was an anomaly for the previous issue. The one before that was doing 1,888 units. So the attrition has slowed, but that's a shame because I think it's definitely a niche kind of a thing, but for the audience it hits. I think they ought to be happy with it, I would hope. Anyways.
So now I kind of shifted gears a little bit and I sorted by percent delta. And I went to sendings, kind of seeing what the highest ones are. Oddly enough, Knights of the Dinner Table was the highest with a 75.6% increase. Walking Dead, 192 was next. Obviously, we know the events of 191 that led to the spike of 192. And then we had the spike of 193.
But no spike but for 194.
No, no, it's a dip.
Everyone's jumping off at that point. I don't get it. No, I'm kidding.
I'm actually looking at the fourth one down, Criminal Number 5, up 43%, 6,000 units, no variance, no nothing. So that strikes me as odd. I can't come up with any reason as to why the fifth issue would be, I mean, it's a new story arc, but it just seems odd that people would bump it up that heavily.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Especially when all the other issues have either they're available, they're in stock, or you can buy additional printings of them. So that was kind of interesting. Spawn 298 continues to jump up every month. We are seeing more and more sales as we get close to 300. 300 is going to be ballistic and off of the charts because of all the covers they have. I think that culminates in a 1 in 100, a couple of 1 in 50s. So that's going to be 300 will be a fun spike. I'm going to assume that it's going to sell at least 100,000. I wonder if it's going to hit 150.
It technically will not outsell The Walking Dead, though, because The Walking Dead has ended.
This is true. But it now can carry the mantle of being the highest selling Image title.
True. The question is, will it be the highest ongoing? I'm not saying that Kirkman ended The Walking Dead just to avoid that, but I'm not saying he didn't either. I'm curious how Spawn does after issue 300. If he's able to leverage the excitement out of being the first Image title to hit 300 and can actually run with that, get some new readers on board and keep going, I think that's awesome. I think I still stand by my statement that equating it to the Cerebus run is mixing apples and oranges.
Yeah. Creator versus creators. And
yeah. Again, hitting 300 issues though, impressive.
Oh yeah. And especially being the kind of the one holdout who didn't go back.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see now we got Tony Stark Iron Man that's up 30-some% as well. I'm just checking right now to see if there's any reason why that would be. That one didn't jump out. There's a Battle Lines variant. I'm just gonna see here, which is open to order, but there was also a variant the month before, the Asgardian variant, so also open to order. It's interesting how that would jump up.
I think
almost 11,000 units.
With the open to order, it comes down to who's the artist.
Yeah, 11,000 units though seems a bit much. But hey, good for them.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's any others that look like there was something. Immortal Hulk continuing to go up, adding another 11,800. Those are open order variants. No, I think that's about it. I'm gonna kind of. No, I think that's probably about what I've got. Now, you've got the creator breakdown tab. Is that something that's still in beta, or do we want to go look at it?
Yes to both.
Okay.
I have not spent any time cleaning it up, so I'm sure there's still a couple of things that are less than ideal about it. Again, I'm just grabbing whatever's the raw data and looking at it. This time, the total units by writer at the top of that leaderboard is Jason Aaron. Followed by Jed McKay and then Brian Michael Bendis, then Tom Taylor, Greg Pak. There's not a huge amount of difference between the first couple of people. In other words, it's not like there's somebody just skyrocketed and then it just drops off.
Right.
We look at the total units by artist. Trevor Foreman has a noticeable lead over Ryan Otley and Michael Janin and then Trevor Harrison. And then from there, it's not as much of a, you know, again, Travel Foreman's out there by, I'm going to say almost 100,000 above Otley.
Yeah.
So I find this kind of interesting, just to see what names are popping up there. I mean, I would not have pegged Jed McKay as having the second most units for a writer on the board.
Yeah, he's Black Cat.
That makes sense. That's why I wouldn't have thought about it.
I was trying to rack my brain. I'm like, what the heck did he do? Why is he? And then I realized he only had one item. It was 255. It was the number one. And then Travel Foreman is the interior artist for it.
That makes sense. Okay. I think
Otley, his two items are the Spider-Man issues, right? He's the Spider-Man artist.
Yeah, that's the change I need to make to this, is to have a column that lists what the hell they had.
Oh, yeah, that'd be good.
Be very handy. Tom King is 7-8 names down the list on the writer's side. Just a little below Nick Spencer and Scott Snyder.
Well, here, let's take a look. So let's look at these total units by writer. Mm-hmm. And I think you're going to see the trend, obviously, that we see in the overall percentages. But it goes Marvel, Marvel, DC, DC, Marvel, Marvel, DC, Marvel, DC. It's a significant amount, I mean, which is what you expect to see. Jason Aaron, 6 items. Bendis, 5. Greg Pak, 7. Donny Cates, 3. Matt Rosenberg, 4. Some guys have quite a load.
Yeah.
This is actually kind of interesting just to look at.
Well, Greg Pak in particular having 7 items.
Is he doing the Star Wars, Age of Republic, Age of Rebellion, those ones?
I'm about to filter the list to go find out what he's got. And I think I limited it to the top 300 for the leaderboard.
Yeah.
He's got Age of the Republic, Darth Vader, Age of the Republic, Luke Skywalker, War of the Realms, New Agents of Atlas, 3 issues of that. Firefly, Ronan Island, James Bond, War of the Realms, 4 issues of New Agents of Atlas, and then one below the radar, which is Star Wars Age of the Republic, Han Solo. Some of those are reorder activity, I believe, for the New Agents of Atlas.
It looks like there were 2 items that were reorder.
I think the first and second issues of New Agents of Atlas, and then 3 and 4 were new for this month.
That's still 7 new items and 2 reorders. That's impressive. And Bendis with 5 new items and 2 reorder. And same thing, Jason Aaron, 6. I mean, there's clearly some guys out there that are doing some major work.
Yeah, well, I think with Greg Pak, if you were to consider, well, obviously New Agents of Atlas was its own miniseries, so you could get in a role and just plow through that. Not trying to diminish his work, but I'm just saying it's not like you're switching gears. That may help.
Yeah, for sure.
But then Age of the Republic, I haven't read those, so I don't know if there's that sort of Darth Vader, Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, that kind of, hey, you're in the zone, can get through that. But both of those also may have been done ahead of time to fit the release schedule they had. I'm curious how many stories he's getting out a week, a month, to sustain this kind of release pace, or how much of it was just kind of stockpiled by the publishers. Whereas, man, Bendis, Event Leviathan, Superman, Action Comics, Young Justice, Pearl, Naomi, and then the Superman event, Leviathan Rising special, with Naomi and that Leviathan Rising having been, reorder activity. So 5 new items. But that's 5 different properties.
Yep.
But you could argue it's still a one a week kind of thing, maybe. But it's Bendis. He's more prolific than that. We know that.
Yep.
Yeah, it's interesting how that one top item can really kind of skew the numbers just a little bit here.
Kind of a fun look, though. I'm glad you added this in.
I'm wondering if there's some other stats that would be worth doing in terms of, like, average or something like that.
Yeah, like average issues, average units per item, trending, some sort of trending.
Something, yeah. I'm just trying to think. If you did the average, it would make Jed McKay look like he's doing stellar versus, say, Greg Pak, where his stuff would, he's got less across more.
Right.
So it might overpronounce that gap in a misleading way. If people have thoughts as to what would be interesting stats to do on this kind of a leaderboard, let me know. For the chart I put together in the spreadsheet, I do have the total units by writer and artist cap at 1,000. Not 1,000, 1,000,000. Figuring, surely somebody could do that if they had an event book or two. But this way, it's at least a common metric from month to month. But it does mean a lot of these people are only hitting this first little bar of 50,000 units or something.
Right.
But I had to pick something. If we look at the price points, unsurprisingly, $399 is like the lion's share of it, with like 84% of the top 300 and 80% of the top 500. It's the dominant price point. I think the only time we need to worry is if we start seeing $499 getting to be bigger and bigger, which we're probably going to.
As long as the books get bigger and bigger.
Yeah, that's the thing, is the price point can go up if the value is better, but if the price point goes up and the page count doesn't, that's a losing proposition for everybody.
Yep.
I do think that longer page counts are better, just because the 20-page story, we're not getting enough with the decompressed storytelling style that's standard these days.
Yes.
It's so standard that calling it decompressed is almost a misnomer now.
It's just pressed.
Yeah. It's depressed, at the very least. I just think they need to get better return on the investment in terms of a reader's enjoyment, and I think that'd get some of the sales going up.
Yep.
So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
No, I think that does it for me. If we didn't have any questions, I'd say we're done.
If we had them, I didn't notice them. So we'll pick them up next time if we did.
Next time, type them louder.
Yeah, exactly. Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify that you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust and needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or a few scanned items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath logic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.